Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
From KQED in San Francisco and Public Radio International, it's Pacific Time. The verdict on an American gold mining firm and why it's attracting a lot of attention. Students in Hawaii connect with their island's heritage in gym class. And we infiltrate the ivory towers of Asian studies.
30 seconds or less, what's the point of your paper and why should we care?
Pacific Time, reporting on the connections between Asia, America, and our Asian American communities. Welcome to Pacific Time. I'm Juan Ha. A professor of economics and physics, an activist who took on a powerful gas company, and a fisherman from Iceland. What do they have in common? They're all winners of the Goldman Environmental Prize. The award comes with a check, $125,000. It was presented this week in San Francisco. The award recognizes one individual in each of six regions for their role in fighting to protect the natural environment. Mostly ordinary folks who didn't like what was happening in their communities and took action. And the Asian winner this year is literally from the grassroots.
For outstanding environmental achievement in Asia, the 2007 Goldman Environmental Prize is awarded to Setskav Munkbayar, Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia.
Munkbayar grew up in a family of nomadic herders. They relied on the rivers of the arid steppes for drinking water, but after Mongolia gained independence from the Soviet Union, it faced a budget crisis. So the Mongolian government allowed international mining companies to search for gold and other minerals without much regard for environmental consequences.
I'm just an ordinary herdsman, but I could see that rivers and lakes in the countryside were drying up because of the mining activities. Because of that, many people had to leave the places where they had been living and move to cities and towns where there was water. We herders were faced with having to abandon our traditional nomadic lifestyle because there wasn't enough water anymore for us and for our animals. I just couldn't stand the thought of that, so I had to do something.
Munkbayar organized other nomads and formed a group which successfully lobbied the government to pass water protection laws. They also initiated a public education campaign to protect Mongolia's water resources from any further unregulated mining. Today, the river in his home district, which had been dry for more than 8 years, is flowing freely again. In Indonesia, the ruling on a criminal case against an American gold mining firm is stirring a lot of reaction on the archipelago and abroad. Newmont Mining, the world's second largest producer of gold, was acquitted this week by an Indonesian court. The firm, headquartered in Denver, Colorado, was accused of dumping dangerous waste, toxic mercury and arsenic, into Buyat Bay off Indonesia's Sulawesi Island. Residents there complained of skin rashes and dizziness. The trial was watched closely by environmental groups who hoped it would send a strong message that Indonesia was getting serious about environmental protection. And foreign investors monitored the case with unease. For more on this, I spoke to an expert on Indonesia, Stanford professor Don Emerson and Catherine Kumans of advocacy group Mining Watch in Canada. Emerson explained that the case comes at an important juncture for Indonesia.
Indonesia has undergone, and in some ways is still undergoing, a turbulent transition from the authoritarian regime of President Suharto. And a number of sort of destabilizing events and trends have occurred, both in politics but also in the economy. So you have this kind of ironic situation in which global investment in mining is, I think, the highest it's been since 1997. Commodity prices are buoyant, and Indonesia is rich in minerals. And yet, the percentage of global investment in the mining sector in Indonesia is really below average for a country of that kind of endowment.
We actually invited Newmont to join our conversation today, but the company declined. I interviewed Omar Jabara, Newmont's spokesman, earlier today, and he had this to say.
Our good name is restored, which is something the judges even said in their 260-page verdict, that we were entitled to have our reputations restored as a result of this nearly two-year ordeal. And we're also very happy for the people of Buyat Bay who've had to live with this stigma of pollution that was non-existent. Nearly 2 years now they've been living with a stigma, people thinking that their fish are polluted, that their waters are polluted, when that is absolutely not the case.
Catherine, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I think that's a perspective on the part of Newmont that really is not warranted. There's a difference, there's a clear difference between a case where there's found to be not enough evidence to proceed with that case and a case in which Newmont can confidently say that there has been no contamination of that bay by its practices. Quite frankly, the very fact that Newmont was dumping mine tailings into that bay is contamination of that bay. That is polluting that bay, and it is, in fact, something that Newmont, as a U.S.-based company, would not be allowed to do in the U.S. Under the Clean Water Act provisions of the U.S., this would not be allowed. So clearly, they have contaminated that bay. They've dumped industrial waste into that bay, and that's not where it belongs.
And it seems that this method of disposal of tailings, the ground-up rock and other waste at sea using a submarine pipe, this is really at the heart of the debate against mining in Asia, is it not?
Well, it's one of the problems with waste, mine waste contamination of the environment. And one of the things you have to understand around mining, and I was very interested to hear the case being made by Professor Don Emerson around Indonesia. It's a very similar case could be made, for example, in the Philippines, where also the Philippines is very rich in minerals, and yet there is not nearly the mining activity that one might expect. And again, it's because civil society is very strongly opposed to mining in the Philippines, and that really has slowed down the mine development. And they're opposed for very good reasons. The big problem with mining is the waste-to-product ratio. So you can have 20,000 tons of mine waste, for example, for one gold ring if you're going to be mining gold. So there's a huge amount of waste. That's problematic for two reasons. We're talking about countries where agricultural land is very important, where there's high population density, so people need land for living and for agriculture to feed themselves. So just having that amount of waste is in and of itself problematic. It's also problematic because if you don't contain it and it leaks or seeps into the environment, it can be highly toxic.
Professor Emerson, I was wondering, can you talk a little bit about the role of the Indonesian government? I mean, it must be kind of a tricky balancing act of trying to protect the environment and yet encouraging much-needed foreign investment.
Well, that's right. I mean, listening to Catherine, I can't help but ask myself the question, you know, is there a technical solution, a scientific solution, or is the implication of what Catherine has said that all mining in Indonesia should be shut down, or at least all mining that is adjacent to some body of water? Because if one puts oneself in the position of an Indonesian, and mind you, I'm not saying that the contract of work that Newmont signed, and according to which Newmont pays royalties and taxes to the Indonesian government, I'm not saying that that revenue is necessarily spent in a way that maximizes the reduction of poverty, the improvement of health and welfare in the population. Corruption is a serious problem in Indonesia. I don't deny that. Nevertheless, it is a democratic country, and I think the government does feel obliged to try to use the resources that it has to elevate the standard of living of the population, to improve the economy. And it's therefore torn between environmental protection as a priority on the one hand and economic growth as a priority on the other. I wish I had a kind of clear ethical bottom line here, thou shalt not do X. But I don't, because I think one has to weigh different priorities from the standpoint of Indonesians that obviously want both. They want clean environment, and they also want to be better off materially.
I think the way I would look at this is that this is a U.S.-based company. They would not, Newmont would not be allowed to do what they're doing in Indonesia in the U.S. Now, why should people, just because they're in an underdeveloped country, accept a level of environmental degradation that is unrecoverable? Once you dump these tailings in the sea, whatever impact that's going to have on the marine environment, which is what people need to eat, you know, this is where they get their food, can't be changed. You know, you can't recover those tailings. That's a system that's particularly bad because you can't do anything about it if things go wrong.
Don Emerson is director of the Southeast Asia Forum at Stanford University. Catherine Kumans is research coordinator at Mining Watch in Ottawa, Canada. The case was also closely watched by the American investors of Newmont Mining. At its annual meeting this week, shareholders passed a resolution that calls for the company to produce a report. It'll address opposition to Newmont's operations by the local communities it operates in. Coming up, we'll go back to school for a gym class with a lot of rhythm. You're listening to Pacific Time on PRI, Public Radio International. When you think back to your high school gym classes, maybe you remember spirited games of basketball or those dreaded laps around the track. You probably don't remember this. But in Honolulu, hula dancing is just what you'll find in PE class at the Laboratory School, a charter school run by the University of Hawaii's College of Education. Lisa Morehouse audited the class.
As the final class of the day begins, 26 ninth graders swarm into the cafeteria of the lab school, some rambunctious and playful, some wearing skull and blazon sweatshirts. The students move lunch tables to the side of the room, then take off their flip-flops and join the chant circle led by instructor Allison Hartle.
Doing the oli, A-L-A-A. I'll do the kahea. Standing, both feet flat on the ground. Stand up straight. I kahea, you match pitch. Everybody first time around, eventually we're going to break it down between the guys and the girls. I-A-L-A-A. A-L-A-A kahiki kue, A-L-A-A kahiki moe, A-L-A-A-ho-i.
Logan Meyer memorized this chant on the first day of the semester. He's a tall, stocky boy with a shock of curly hair and a wide smile. As a young child, he ignored his grandmother's attempts to interest him in hula, but taking this class has unearthed his hidden talent.
I don't know, it was like a rhythm, so I just started just singing it as a rhythm, and it got easier every time I said it. Plus, my mom knew it, so she taught me how to.
That's music to the ears of staff members at the lab school. They began requiring all ninth graders to take one semester of hula and chant a few years ago. Counselor Tracy Teixeira describes how hula fits with the school's vision, which bucks the national trend of cutting arts classes in favor of more test preparation instruction.
Everybody is included in art, PE, music, science, every single day. It's kind of like a Renaissance school where we believe everything is important, of equal importance. So math is not more important than performing arts, as English, PE, social studies. Everything equals.
The school's student population mirrors the ethnic, economic, and educational diversity of Oahu, and students here consistently succeed academically. Classes in the core curriculum weave in elements of performance, and with the abundance of storytelling, interpretation, and vocabulary, Allison Hartle's hula class at the lab school is as much about literature as dance.
I make them do a lot of vocabulary looking up, and then I explain context and why certain words mean one thing in one context and something else in another, and explaining kona, the underlying meanings.
In fact, in the middle of this class, a student asks for a translation of the word ami, the quick, circular hip movement that eludes many students today.
Question? What is ami? Ami actually is a hinge. A hinge. Like a joint, a hinge. So it should be like a hinge.
Because Hawaiian is actually a very poetic language where you say one thing literally and there are different layers of meaning underneath which are telling different stories at the same time. So we kind of talk about all of that because I give to them as their kuleana the responsibility that they need to know what they're dancing about.
Even student Miranda Glenn admits the vocabulary homework her teacher assigns is helpful.
Since most of us, actually all of us, don't speak Hawaiian, it's mostly just a lot of memorization with the hands. So if you know the actual storyline, it's a little bit easier to remember what you're actually trying to do. So you don't mix up the flowers with the lava.
And then she demonstrates, moving her hands gracefully to mimic a lava flow.
A lot of times we have to form the lava moving, so we kind of swish our fingers or put it down and bump over things. And a lot of it's making the land, so you just keep your hands flat at flat level so it shows that it's land.
Students get a lot of exercise in this class, more than 40 minutes of hula a day, according to teacher Allison Hartle. But while the PE credit for hula has a certain credibility, she says the true impact of the class is much broader.
The idea of the class is to not only have a movement class where they can get some PE credit as well for dancing, but that there's actually meaning behind it, and it's an art form, and it tells stories, and it's history and culture all in one.
Back in the 1970s, a statewide renaissance of Hawaiian history and culture brought traditional hula and chant back into the public sphere. Since then, the lab school has offered its students a range of culturally based courses, including ones in Hawaiian language and oral histories of the Pacific.
The real reason that we keep it is because it's, you know, a teaching tool for so many different facets of the culture. And just letting kids do exploring, which is what students are supposed to do.
Makoko.
These days, all ninth graders study the modern history of Hawaii along with hula and chant. And older students can deepen their knowledge with electives on Hawaiian culture. Chelsea Kagawan is a ninth grader in the class.
Our hula is, well, right now we're learning about a lot of hulas about Pele, which is a fire goddess. And we had to learn about her, so we're basically learning about the Hawaiian culture.
Counselor Tracy Teixeira says she's seen the lasting impact of hula. By requiring the students to take hula and chant, the lab school encourages the kukui, or light, to go off in their heads, connecting these teenagers to Hawaii's heritage.
The kids who've gone on to college have said that the hula class has helped them a lot to integrate into the college life and the Hawaii Club. It made them feel connected back to home, even if they weren't of blood Hawaiian, but it made them feel connected to home, and this is their home.
For Pacific Time, this is Lisa Morehouse in Honolulu.
In the world of higher education, the annual meeting of the Association of Asian Studies is the place for scholars in the field to see and be seen. 3,151 people turned up at the meeting in Boston last month for an intellectual schmooze. They did a lot of talking and used a lot of big words. We sent reporter Jocelyn Ford to translate it into plain English.
To look down upon China and the West.
China imported TV programs. This is not just about cartoons, but the
government of Mongolia.
During the 1970s, was heavily influenced by the Japanese shoujo manga
met
culture.
Alexander the Great, and he just lived in the bathtub and just kind of ate whatever. He was basically a homeless person just by choice.
Thousands of scholars, 228 sessions on everything from the obscure try sewers in 19th century Calcutta to the predictable, like the future of Japan-China economic relations. I figure if the 21st century is going to be the Asian century, as some are predicting, these are the folks who will be helping the rest of us get clued in. So I prowled the halls of the Boston Marriott to get a preview of the scholars' passions and predilections.
Only way to get up to the fifth floor.
I caught up with the president of the Association for Asian Studies, Professor Anand Yang. He helped me navigate the corridors.
If I could just ask you a couple of questions. How is the state of Asian studies?
Asian studies is thriving.
It's not just thriving. He said the United States is the world leader.
Among the people who are knowledgeable about Asian studies, we're a superpower.
But There is a but.
But as a percentage of the overall population, we're minuscule, and we haven't made quite the inroads we should in terms of developing that knowledge in the K-12 system as well as in higher education.
And it gets worse. Like, who's listening to all these experts?
A lot of that knowledge is not even prized in official circles. We're not in their inner councils of policymaking in the United States.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I set off down the halls to meet the scholars who are helping us prepare for an Asia-centric world. I popped my head in the Mongolia Society meeting in the middle of a presentation.
Typical for pronunciation mistakes of foreigners learning Mongolian.
Seems Westerners often mangle Mongolian pronunciation so badly, they're incomprehensible. At least, that's what I thought the speaker was trying to convey.
Mistakes which foreigners make is, for example, the Mongolian del. Foreigners usually pronounce del instead del. And ul instead ul.
I ducked out early. Bumped into Michael Jerrison on the escalator.
30 seconds or less, what's the point of your paper and why should we care?
The point of my paper, I found a secret covert group of military soldiers that are ordaining as monks that are unbeknownst to most of the people in Thailand or the world, and it really seeks for a compromise of Buddhist ethics and practice.
Only 12 seconds. Time left over for the why it matters question.
You think about the way in which Islam has been segmented as a religion of violence and how Buddhism has been orientalized as a non-violent religion. I'm trying to right now show how a Buddhist state is just as much viable for violence as any other.
Not a topic, he says, that gets much attention. He says it's the first panel ever on the subject at the world's leading Asian studies conference. There were many intriguing panels. The little-known group of Rohingya Muslims in Burma who want independence. The online community in Japan that worships ramen noodles. There were mysteries, like why was Japan's Emperor Hirohito never shown in World War II art? The answer has to do with Japan's indigenous Shinto religion.
So not being able to see means that he's too sacred, he's too significant to be seen. So that actually elevated the status of his divinity.
Art historian Mayo Tsuruya. And then there were mystifying papers, like one titled Anaphores or Cataphores, a discussion of two chi graphs. That became part two of my pop quiz. Extra points for the scholars who could figure out what on earth it was about.
You willing to take my little quiz here?
Yes, okay.
Here it is again, anaphores or cataphores. For many, it was a real stumper.
Oh my God.
I honestly have no clue.
Something to do with some medieval Chinese text?
Anaphores and pinafores? Oh, my God. I don't know. It's late. I've worked all day. I don't think I'm going to come up with an answer.
Unfortunately, at the conference, I failed to find the elusive author. So I called him up.
Hello?
It turns out Gil Raz is a Taoist scholar at Dartmouth College, and his paper was about the elliptical first chapter of the Book of Tao, or Tao Te Ching in Chinese. It's the book of wisdom that's inspired many aspects of Chinese philosophy, culture, and society. Here's the test. It's what does your paper say? Tell me in 30 seconds or less. All right?
Okay.
Here we go.
The title is Anaphores or Cataphores, a discussion of the two Qi graphs in the first chapter of the Tao Te Ching.
Mm-hmm.
But our analysis shows that this, in fact, refers probably to the book itself. And what this chapter
And since
really
he went
is,
well over his 30 seconds, I've taken the liberty to shorten his answer.
And the book is, in fact, the Tao. It's not just about the Tao, but the words of the book are the words of the Tao. So it's a very, very big claim, and it really is changes the way we should read the entire book, I think.
Are you basically telling me that you've sort of cracked the equivalent, the Taoist equivalent of the Da Vinci Code?
Very close, yes.
And in case you didn't quite catch the gist, I got Gil to rephrase the message of the Book of Tao.
The real message of this book is that human beings should align themselves with the process by which the universe operates.
The problem with we humans is that we think some things are permanent and they aren't.
We don't understand that the only permanent thing is change. And if we could align ourselves with this change, yes, we would have a much better world.
And about those anaphores and cataphores, look them up. They're in some dictionaries. for Pacific Time. I'm Jocelyn Ford in Boston.
Still can't find that dictionary? These are grammatical terms. An anaphore is a pronoun that refers to something that was already mentioned. A cataphore is a pronoun that refers to a subject that hasn't yet been mentioned. And some final notes from around Asia and Asian America. There's a wrinkle to Japan's wartime practice of enslaving women to provide sex for its troops during World War II. Recently discovered documents show that the Japanese set up official brothels for American GIs after the U.S. occupied the island. The documents show U.S. officials condoned the practice until General Douglas MacArthur shut down the brothels in 1946. In business news, Japan is adding its name to a trade complaint filed by the U.S. government over China's lax enforcement of piracy and intellectual property rights. The complaint is being lodged at the World Trade Organization. The European Union is also considering joining the suit. And Asian American civil rights groups are calling on CBS Radio to fire two New York shock jocks who made a prank phone call to a Chinese restaurant. Jeff Vandergrift and Dan Lay were suspended this week for the prank, which included racial and sexual slurs, as well as a joke about fried rice that most of us heard in the second grade. It's time for us to run. Our theme music was composed by Anthony Brown with the Asian American Orchestra. Visit us on the web at kqed.org/pacific time. Our staff includes Nina Thorson, Seal Muller, Sarah Bond, Lita Snyder, Dan Bringer, and Raul Ramirez. And I'm Juan Ha. Thanks for tuning in.
Funds for the production of Pacific Time are provided by the Freeman Foundation, Matthews International Capital Management, a San Francisco-based advisor investing in the future of Asia since 1994, the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, and the KQED Campaign for the Future Program Venture Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.